Thank you very much, Murray, as we have said, and the floor is yours. So whenever you want, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can I check? You can hear me okay?
Yes, all is fine.
All is fine. Okay, I'll share my presentation. And you can see that first slide there.
Yes.
Good. Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm speaking to you from Inverness in Scotland by the miracle of technology. I would far rather be with you in Girona, but here we are. So I'm going to speak to you this afternoon about the work we've done in Scotland to manage the national park and especially to manage tourism in a sustainable way. I'm going to speak for 30 to 40 minutes, I think, and I'll go through some slides, but and I'll try and speak slowly. I have a tendency to speak very fast, but if I go too fast, Jordi, and I'm not being understood, please tell me, and I can change. So the Cairngorms National Park is part of a family of national parks. Can I check the slides are changing? I think there's a little
they are not changing, but no, before it used to work, so
yeah, there's a little delay.
Yes, it's working.
It's working. Okay, so the Cairngorms National Park is part of a family of national parks that we have in the United Kingdom, and I hope you know the geography of the United Kingdom is surprisingly complicated, but in the north of the island there we have Scotland with two national parks in blue, and we're going to be talking about the big one to the north, and then to the south of the island there, England and Wales, there are other national parks that are designated with different legislation but still quite similar. So you can see, I think, that the Cairngorms National Park is a very big area in a relatively small country. The size of the national park is about 4,500 kilometers square, and it is centered on a mountainous area with all of the valleys around about it, all included within the national park. So that's good. The slides are changing. Jordi said in the introduction, I am a geographer by training, so I like to start with some maps. Otherwise, I can't make sense of anything. So you see there, the national park is centered on a mountain area, and it has a lot of communities and roads and settlements within the national park. And if you know, some of you perhaps have been to Scotland, you'll know that these areas are still quite remote in Scotland. So we're not talking about a large number of people. It's still very much a rural area. The road on the left there is the main road that goes through from Edinburgh all the way to Inverness in the north of Scotland, and the road goes right through the national park that was built long before the national park was established in 2003. So first of all, I want to say a few words about the early days of the national park, because it was designated in 2003, and there was a long debate in Scotland about the establishment of national parks. And for a long time, we didn't have a system of national parks. We had other protected areas, about nature reserves or sites of special scientific interest or landscape designations, but we didn't have anything that we called national parks. And that was even when many other countries had national parks. But this particular part of Scotland was a very controversial area, and it's summarised in the title of that book there by a man who wrote, he did his PhD on the 100 years of controversy between nature, development and environment between 1880 and 1980. And this was always a very controversial area, and it was controversial for a few different reasons. One was that different boundaries of the local authorities, I think that the municipalities, if you like, they all met in the middle of the mountains. So each municipality was only responsible for managing one small part of the mountains, and no one had the complete overview. And then there was also a dispute about national interests. This was a nationally important area for wildlife and mountain scenery, but it was also a place where local people lived, and therefore it was controversial between who decided what happened, and we'll talk about that later. And then it was controversial as well because of some issues directly to do with tourism. Some people wanted to develop the area for the skiing industry, and the very parts they wanted to use for the skiing industry were also very sensitive areas for wildlife and landscape, and that was causing controversy too. So the national park was put in place as a way to help resolve and manage a way through this complexity and this controversy. So the mountains are within a relatively small country. This is the biggest and best place for wild nature in the whole of the United Kingdom. And we'll talk a bit about that. The mountains are quite rounded mountains. They are 10,000 years ago, the whole of Scotland was covered by one big ice sheet. So the mountains in this part of Scotland are quite well rounded. They've been eroded away by the glaciers, and they are four of the five highest mountains in the UK are in the National Park. The mountains are about 1,400 metres high. So they're not the highest mountains, but they are quite a severe climate because we're a long way north. This is well above the natural tree line, and people describe it as a little bit of the Arctic that is brought south into the UK because of the altitude of the mountains. So no trees would grow here. There's a few birds that stay and breed here almost throughout the year. Very important populations of dotterel and ptarmigan and mountain hares. A long time ago in Scotland, we killed off the last of the wolves and the bears, so we don't have those predator animals, but we have big grazing herds of red deer in particular. We'll talk more about that. As well as the tops of the mountains, we also have extensive forest cover, and in the UK, in Scotland, we've lost a lot of our forest cover already, so these are very important areas for us. Very, very beautiful. They're also productive forests, so these are not they are protected and they're managed in a very careful way, but it's still possible for people to extract timber from these areas as long as they go about it in the right way. It's also Cairngorms is also a very important place for recreation. There's about between 5.5 and 6 million people live in Scotland. And you can get here from the two big cities of Edinburgh and Glasgow in about two and a half to 3 hours. So this is a very popular mountain playground. This picture here is taken of a triathlon event that is organised every year. And there's many events where people go in canoes and then on bikes and then running round the loch. The National Mountain Sports Centre is located just half a kilometre from where this picture is taken. So a very important area for recreation. And it's also a place where people live. In the Scottish National Parks, people live within the National Park. And this is quite different from the system in some countries. I think in North America, Canada and the United States especially, typically the people would live outside the national park, and you'd see a big concentration of development and tourism pressure outside the park, immediately around the boundary. In the Scottish parks, we are trying deliberately to include the people within the boundary as a way to help manage the pressure and the growth and change in the settlements. So this is a picture of Bray Mawr, which is in the east of the park on the River Dee, and it probably has a population of about 600 people. It's quite close to Balmoral which is the Queen's, the King's summer residence. So Balmoral is quite famous and gets a lot of visitors, and that's quite close to Braemar here. So when we think about why the national park was designated, one of the key issues was this issue of who decides what happens here. And that is a cartoon that was drawn maybe 20 years ago now by someone in a local community when the national park was first proposed. And they were effectively trying to communicate the fear that a national park would mean that all of the decisions would be taken elsewhere and they would be trampled, the local people would be trampled by this stamp of national park authority by a man in a pinstripe suit. This was a genuine fear at the time that we were trying to manage. And effectively what we did is we found a way around that. We developed a system that means that local people are very involved in making the decisions in the national park. And I'll talk about that later. One of the big issues we have in the national park is to do with the management of the forest, because that picture there looks beautiful, but if you're an ecologist or a forester, you'll quickly realise that all of the trees there are quite old and there's not many young trees. And thankfully, that is a situation that is now changing because we're killing a lot more of the deer, which eat the young trees. Ecologically, this would naturally have happened by the wolves and lynx predating on the deer and keeping the population in balance. But more than 200 years ago, we've killed off all those predators. So we humans have to kill the deer themselves. And that's inevitably a business. People generate a revenue from doing that by selling hunting as an experience and also by eating the meat of venison. But it's hard work. And we're having to work quite hard to make sure the land managers are killing enough deer so that the forest can regenerate. The other issue or big issue set of issues that we have is to do with the management of visitors generally. And we'll talk more about this as I go on. But there are parts of the park that have become a lot more popular quite quickly, especially over the COVID lockdown period. We saw a lot of people coming to the countryside to get fresh air and to get away from other people. The pubs and the cinemas and the shops were closed. So there was very high pressure on the countryside. And I know that that happened in all over Europe and in Spain too. So we've had to do a lot more work to provide car parks for people, in some places to restrict cars from coming up some of the minor roads, and to put more resources into managing people in the countryside. And the last slide in this section was a picture of a ski resort. So we have, there's not much snow in that picture, but that is the summer use of a ski resort. And we have three of the five Scottish ski centres within the Cairngorms National Park. And this uplift facility was very controversial. It still is very controversial. A lot of public money was spent building it, and there was a lot of concern that it was going to introduce too many people up into the high mountains, and then people could walk around and cause damage on the sensitive to the sensitive wildlife. So a deal was developed, a system was developed, whereby if people go up on the train in the mountain, they have to either ski down or they have to come back down on the train. They're not allowed out at the top in order to walk around in the mountains. So if you want to get to the tops of the mountains, you're allowed to go there, but you're not allowed to take the train. And that's controversial. Not everyone understands why that restriction has to be in place. But the mountains, I think, as you saw in the picture, they're quite gentle mountains at the top. And therefore, if you introduce too many people too quickly up to the top, it is too easy for people to go there and we would cause environmental problems. So that's why that system was developed. So that was all by way of introduction about why we have a national park. And now we will look at how we manage the national park and the role that tourism plays in doing that. So first of all, when the national park was designated, four specific aims were developed. And the first one about conservation of nature and culture, the second one about sustainable use of resources, the third one about promoting understanding and enjoyment, and the last one about sustainable economic and social development of communities. And tourism probably fits into all four of those aims, especially the last one, because tourism is a very important driver of the economy in a remote rural area in Scotland. We reckon that about 45% of the jobs in the area are dependent on tourism in some way, and therefore tourism keeps the small shops and the small businesses going in a way that doesn't happen in other parts of Scotland where tourism is not so important. But tourism is relevant to all four of these aims. If the first aim, if we don't look after the nature and the cultural heritage, people are not going to come, or when they do come, they're going to see environmental damage at first hand and they're not going to like it. The second aim is all about sustainable use of resources, and we think that if we do tourism in the right way, we can do that. And the third one is about promoting understanding and enjoyment of the area, and that is very much about tourism. We want this to be an area that people like and enjoy. So how do we manage the national park? Well, the first thing is that we have a national park partnership plan. So it's always good to have a plan. And every 5 years, we write a document that is agreed by all the partners in the area working together. And we submit that document to the government. And the government minister, and that's the lady in the centre there at the moment, she has to consider the plan and then sign it off every 5 years. So it's quite a political process. It requires agreement by our board, our managing board, which is made up of 19 people who don't work full time. They're only paid for a few days a year. But when they meet together, they take the big decisions about managing the area. And they employ the staff like me to do the technical work on writing the plan. So we have a plan, and in that plan there is a vision for the area. We try and set the vision a long way away. We actually wrote this vision a long time ago, and it is about the Cairngorms being a national park where there's an exemplar of nature and people thriving together. Thriving means succeeding together, doing well together. So that's our vision, and we have quite a vision-orientated plan. And then within the plan, we have three big broad sections where we look at nature, people and place. So first of all, on nature, we want this to be a carbon negative and biodiversity rich national park with better functioning and connected resilient ecosystems. On the people side, we want it to be have a well-being economy. We'll talk a bit more about this later on, that works for people of the Cairngorms. And on the place side, we want it to be a place that people want to live in, to work in and to visit, that works for everyone. So that's how we split up the plan. And essentially, the National Park is a place to demonstrate collaboration and cooperation. In the National Park, the land is owned by a lot of different people. It's not all government land. In fact, about 75% of the land is owned privately by private individuals or families, quite often in big estates, what we call estates. I think probably hacienda would be the equivalent in other areas. 75% of the land is owned privately. The remainder is split between public bodies, so government bodies, and then what we call conservation charities. So we have conservation charities like the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, or National Trust for Scotland. So maybe those are membership organisations that people join if they want to try and help protect nature. So it's a mixture of private interests, public interests, and charitable interests, all owning the land and trying to work together. When we first designated the national park, we spent quite a lot of money on these nice signs made out of solid stone. The geology of the area is granite, so we had to decide to spend quite a lot of money to open up a new quarry in the, or an old quarry in the area, and extract some granite. It was controversial at the time because the cost of this was about three times more than it would have been if we had brought the granite from China. But because we are supposed to be about conserving the local place, we decided to spend money and use the granite from Scotland. We also developed this brand image for the national park, and I know some of you are interested in communication and marketing and branding, and there is a lot of our work is about communication. So we developed this brand image as a way to communicate all of the partners in this special place working together. So that is 20 years old now, but it has broadly stood the test of time. The bird involved is an osprey, and it's a fish-eating eagle. You can see the fish that has been caught by the bird. It's the symbol or the logo for the national park. And the language, the Cairngorms National Park, and then below that you see the language Parca Náisiúnta of Onarua, Gaelic. That's it, the name of the national park in Gaelic, which is the traditional language spoken in the north and west of Scotland. So one of the things we did when the national park was designated was to get paintings drawn of the landscape. So these are hand-drawn paintings. These are not digital images, and they show the mountains and the valleys to quite an accurate level. And I wanted to put in this picture because it shows that what we were trying to do was we provided five different perspectives on the landscape. And we wanted to try and present the local communities that are in the national park to the front of, or to the front of the picture. Some of these communities right at the foreground are just outside the national park, but we were trying to find ways to connect people to the landscape and to this new designation, this new protected area. So we did five different perspectives, and we made these pictures available to local businesses and local communities and in visitor centres, etc., to demonstrate how they were connected to the mountains in the background, because this is what so many visitors were coming to experience. But we were, that was a tool we were using to help create this new designation, this new place. The other thing we were trying to do was to try and create a sense of unified management. And when we first started this work, we inherited a lot of good path leaflets. So this is walking leaflets for that different people had developed at different points in time, but they all looked a bit different. So we worked with them to redesign leaflets and the publicity material so that they all looked like part of a series. We provided a template for the local communities to use. And this was quite delicate political work because a lot of the communities were, they liked the way they were doing things, and they didn't want a government agency coming in and telling them how to do things. So we had to negotiate carefully and to make sure that, as well as providing a new template, each of the villages still felt like this was their leaflet about their place. And we've tried to keep that delicate sense of balance between the national interest and the local interest going to this time. The development of the bird image, the Cairngorms National Park logo, helped with that, because that image isn't the mark of any particular organisation. It's the mark, the logo for the area, the symbol of partnership. So in terms of the three sections of the partnership plan, just a few words about some of the bigger projects. We have a bird in living in the national park, Capercaillie. I think in Spanish it's Urugayo. And it's a big grouse that lives in the forest, but it's about the size of a turkey. So it's a very big bird. And this is a bird that is found across Western and Northwest Europe, but in Scotland it is at the very edge of its range. And it's quite a challenging bird to keep alive in the forest, because the forests are being managed and they're being disturbed by walkers and mountain bikers and people with dogs, etc. And also the birds themselves don't seem to help themselves. They keep flying into fences that they don't see. And with changes in climate, some of the plants that they eat are less common. So the population of the bird has declined quite markedly. And we now have about 90% of the Scottish or UK population is within our national park. And we're working very hard to try and make sure it doesn't go extinct, but it's quite hard work. We've done some very good collaborative work with the dog walking community and the mountain biking community to try and divert paths away from the breeding sites, and to build more support for the conservation of capercaillie. We've also been reintroducing species. This is a picture of a beaver, I think. Is it castor in Spanish? And this again is another animal that had gone extinct in Scotland until, well, maybe 15, 20 years ago. It was reintroduced on an experimental basis down in the southwest of Scotland. And then after that, it was reintroduced in a few other areas. And very, very recently, in the last 6 months, we've introduced it to the national park. So this will be a fantastic addition to the wildlife of the area, because you probably know it makes dams and it holds the water back. And that water will then be very good for lots of other wildlife, because farmers have drained a lot of fields. And wetlands, more wetlands will generally be good for wildlife. But it's a very controversial animal, and the farmers are not entirely delighted about this having this animal back. Some of them are, of course, but many of them are not. And this is going to take a lot of work to manage the expansion of the beaver population in a way that keeps the farming community on board and compensates them for any damage to crops or livelihood, etc. So that's a very controversial topic for us right at the moment. We had a meeting about a month ago where there was a protest turned up in one of the local villages with about 15 or 16 tractors parading up and down the high street. And then 80 quite angry farmers in a room talking about beavers. And that was just a month ago. And on the people side of things, we do a lot of work with the business community. We've worked with the business community to make sure their organisation covers the same area as the Cairngorms National Park. So it's the Chamber of Commerce for the National Park, and it's called the Cairngorms Business Partnership. And we encourage them to run a very good visitor website for the park. We try and split up the responsibilities and say, well, you guys are in the tourism business. You're probably better at speaking to visitors and tourists than we are, because we're, government civil servants. So you run the visitor website for the park. And in this slide, you can see they've been developing an online shop to try and make sure that the small shops in the park can sell their detail, all their products online. And we pay them to try and facilitate this work. And it's another good example of the sort of work we do to try and promote the partnerships that are needed in the area. One of the really important pieces of work that underpins our approach to tourism is this Europark Charter for Sustainable Tourism in Protected Areas. And Jordi was saying that Europark is quite well known in Spain, which is great. It is the European Federation for Protected Areas, so national parks, nature parks, etc. And a long time ago, they developed this approach to encourage sustainable tourism. And that was following a piece of work done on called Loving Them to Death, where there was a review done of how tourism was developing in some of these key sites in Europe to try and get the balance better between exploitation and conservation. So the way the charter works is that every 5 years, each of the candidate parks has to develop a plan. And the plan has to be underpinned by these five principles. And once the plan is written, an international verifier or an expert in tourism has to pay a visit and speak to all of the stakeholders and make sure that all of this work is happening at the appropriate level. So the principles are about giving priority to protection, contributing to sustainable development, in engaging with all of the stakeholders, that means all the interested parties, planning tourism effectively, and a commitment to pursue continuous improvement. So those are the five high-level principles that all of the charter parks in Europe should be meeting. And at the moment, there are only two charter parks in the UK, one in Scotland and one in England. And we were the first national park to be awarded, and we've kept that award ever since 2005. So we're very, very proud of that. One thing that's very important to understand about Scotland is that we have a very liberal approach to access to the land. So if you look at that photograph there, the people are walking on a path, but under the law, they are allowed to walk over almost that the whole of that landscape, as long as they behave responsibly. So it doesn't matter if the land is owned privately or by a government body, as long as they're not causing any damage, they have a right to go almost anywhere. And that applies whether you're on foot or on bike or on horseback, and it applies to the land and to inland water, so rivers and lakes as well. And that's a very different system to the system in England, to the south of the UK. They have a much more restrictive system. So our system is very much like the Scandinavian system in Norway and Finland and Sweden. We have these figures here, 55 Munros and 26 Corbett. I'm not sure that means terribly much to you, but Munros is a system of classification of mountains that was done well over 100 years ago, whereby all of the mountains over 3,000 feet, so that's the 3,000 feet is 914 metres, they were all identified and put on a map, and people like to go around Scotland and make sure they have climbed all the Munros. I think there is about 280 of them in Scotland, and we have 55 within the park. But this system of outdoor access is really important, and it works very, very well. Most people behave responsibly. The way in which the responsibility is set out in a book that's approved by the Parliament, and we usually joke that this book is about 135 pages long, and it is all defining what the word responsibly means, because it sets out different circumstances when you're having a picnic or when you're having a when you're pursuing your favoured sport. It sets out exactly how you do that responsibly, and that's all approved by the Parliament. That's a couple of examples there about camping. So generally you're allowed to camp all over Scotland, as long as you do it in the right way. So you should be not having a campfire, but using a stove. You should be taking your rubbish home. You shouldn't be staying too long. You should be taking your human waste away. If you have a dog, you should be keeping it on a lead as far as possible. And if you can, you should be staying to a path, but you don't have to. Overseeing all of this system, we've got a network of rangers. I think, is it guardas forestales in Spanish? And we employ some of the rangers in working in the national park, and then we provide money to other organisations to employ rangers too. So in our national park, surprisingly, we have about 13 or 14 different employers of rangers, all working together, all wearing the badge of the national park. And their job is to encourage people to behave well. We do a lot of work with young people. This is them collecting wild garlic leaves for some cooking experiment. We've also got a program of work with local young people, a training program for junior rangers. And you can see here they're being introduced to deer management. So there's a dead roe deer, and they're being shown the fine arts of how to cut up a carcass. You can tell by the looks on some of their faces what they think of it all. Deer shooting is really important. And this is a picture of a Victorian hall with some old skulls and antlers from all of the deer that have been shot over the years. So again, ecologically, ideally we wouldn't have to do that. The wolves would do it, the lynx would do it, but that doesn't happen because we don't have the wolves and we don't have the lynx, so we have to shoot them. That's just an essential part of looking after the forest and keeping a healthy environment here. I mentioned before this concept of a well-being economy, and this is something that's quite politically fashionable at the moment. We're trying to work towards an economy that is very much about local benefits for local people, an economy that promotes a healthy ecosystem, and an economy that is based on the special natural and cultural qualities of the area. So this is our board chairman talking to a local business owner in a whisky shop, and many of these whiskies will have been made close to the national park or within the national park and are on sale to local people. And that's a good example of what we mean by a well-being economy. We want to try and keep the benefits of the economy as local as possible. We don't want the money to be sucked out by big commercial chains and then given back to us in small portions. We want to try and keep the money circulating locally if we possibly can. And then I was going to speak a little bit about the place part of the partnership. So this is an area of the national park called Badenoch, and it's an area you can perhaps see that was typically flooded, a very wet area. So the beavers will do very well in this part of the park. And in that picture, you can see an old ruined castle, or it's actually a barracks that used to be used in the 18th century. It was on a very important hill pass. And in this area, we've been working with the local community to try and develop some programs to help look after their cultural heritage. So that's a reconstruction of what that ruined building would have looked like. And we've paid for these revisualizations of the local barracks so that the local community can use these in their tourism literature. And we very much want to develop this kind of tourism based on local culture and heritage and history. This is another reconstruction of a hill fort going back to the Pictish times when people lived. And if you go to that hilltop now, you can't really see anything other than just the foundation stones. But these reconstructions help people interpret how people used to live probably 1,500 years ago, maybe a little bit more. The other thing that we're trying to do through this work is to encourage local people to manage their own tourism projects, not necessarily as businesses, but as local people working together. So that's a map on our website where you can see the distribution of these local community initiatives. And if you click on each marker, you can see the details. In this one community of Braemar, they've got an amazing array of community-owned facilities. So the community has taken on this castle and they employ the local people to work in the castle and show it off to visitors. And they've got a community hydro scheme, they've got community sports facilities, they run the caravan park, they run the golf club. And these are what we call social enterprises, whereby it's being run as a business, but any profit that is made goes back into the local community. And it's another very good example of what we mean by a well-being economy. No one is extracting a profit here where the money is being taken away from the park. The money is being reinvested in the park and employing local people. We also have, in this Badenoch area, we've developed some apps around storytelling. We're keen to ensure that a lot of good stories are told about the area in a way that connects people to the land. So we are really interested to see how that app develops. And then in the final part of the presentation, I wanted to give you a sense of the work we have just started or is coming up. And Jordi, in a minute, I'll ask you to show the video. But we have a big programme called Cairngorms 2030, which you can find out more about on our website. And it is a project trying to address the twin challenges of climate change and also the biodiversity crisis, where people are very worried that nature is getting to a point where we're seeing so much damage to nature and so many extinctions that we're going to go over a critical threshold. And that's a picture there of somebody holding some sphagnum moss, which is a very wet moss and holds a lot of water. And we've developed this programme of different projects which are all trying to address these twin climate and biodiversity crises. So Jordi, if you could switch to the video now, you'll see a 3-minute video where local people are trying to set out the rationale for this programme. Okay, I don't know, I couldn't hear any of the
Yes, well, in fact, we have seen the video.
Okay.
Yes, okay.
Okay, good. I'll just keep going with a few more slides and then you can ask me questions. So this program is a partnership program which we've put together over a 7-year period, and we have about 40 different partners involved, and the total value of the project is about £40 million. So it's a huge project for us. And I've explained the rationale about why we're having the program, and it was in the video. It's underpinned by this concept that comes from this Gaelic word, duchas, which means this deep-rooted connection between people and nature. It's not a word we have in English at all. And I'm just checking the slides are still changing here. Yeah. We developed this project after a lot of discussion with local people. We reckon we've involved about 4,000 people in the discussion phase of this, including a lot of school children, volunteers and artists involved in some elements of the programme. We're going to be, over the next 5 to 6 years, delivering 20 different projects which are going to transform the way the land is managed for nature, help the communities shape the future of their area, develop active travel and better paths between the communities, and put health issues very much to the fore, trying to make sure people are getting out in nature and staying healthy. And to do that, we've got 20 separate projects, and we're just recruiting staff to deliver these at the moment. And I won't go through all of these in detail, but just to pick out a few different things. Under this empowering communities banner, we're trying to educate people better about climate change. We're trying to develop better ways to engage with the local people so that they can help manage the area. Under the travel theme, we're trying to develop better opportunities for biking so that people, even if they have to come here by car, they can leave their car and then travel in other ways. And then over on the left, quite a lot of work on this restoration of peatland. And peat is turba, I think, in Spanish. And this is this form of soil that is made up of plant material decomposing over a very long period of time. We have very important areas of peatland in Scotland, and these areas can absorb huge quantities of carbon from the atmosphere. So we hope that a combination of peatland restoration and woodland expansion will help soak up a lot of carbon, and we can make the whole national park overall net zero. So this is the last slide. Just to say that, you know, we've made good progress. We think we've got good plans. but there are a lot of challenges ahead, the biggest of which is probably climate change. And we're already starting to see that in the Cairngorms. We're dependent on government money for a lot of our work, so we have to be sure that we still have political support so that the money keeps coming. We've got to issues of capacity and energy to deal with. Quite often the work we're trying to do here is about quite long-term planning, and sometimes it's hard to keep people motivated and politically supportive because they want to see progress being made more quickly. We are trying to get away from grants, meaning short-term grants are a form of short-term funding where we're giving people money for 1 or 2 years so that people can be sure they can plan in a longer way. And lastly, bureaucracy. You know, we're bedeviled sometimes with too much paperwork and too many emails, and the need to get on and do some of this work on the ground is quite urgent. So we're all trying to find ways to be more efficient and plan the work better. So I think that was my last slide, but if Jordi, I'll pass back to you and people can ask questions.
Ray, I don't know, but you will hear an applause from the audience, because thank you very much for the presentation. Okay. Now, as you were saying, it is turn for questions, and if there are some reflections or if someone wants to because you can see us. So if you have any question or if you would like to add a comment or whatever, please, it's better if you can come here, because thank you. Okay.
Just a short question. Have you ever thought about the reintroduction of wolves and bears?
Yes, it gets suggested from time to time. At the moment, the reintroduction of beaver is quite controversial. So we're starting with that. The next possibility would be a reintroduction of lynx, which is an animal I think you already are familiar with in Spain. But it would be a different subspecies, I think, not the Iberian lynx, but a different subspecies. And there are no firm proposals for that yet, but there's quite a number of people who think it would be a good idea because they would live in the forest and they would kill the smaller deer. The challenge for us is that we have a lot of grazing animals in Scotland, sheep and cows. And the farming community are very important in the rural areas, and inevitably they would find it very challenging. Wolves are very difficult for us at the moment. Because we're an island in the UK, we have to make a conscious decision to reintroduce them. They can't just arrive here naturally, as they would in, you know, even quite industrialized countries like the Netherlands or Belgium. And that makes it politically difficult. You would have to make a conscious decision to reintroduce them. And at the moment, that's not going to happen anytime very soon. But ecologically, some of these reintroductions would really help deal with some of the environmental challenges we face. So we'll have to see and keep talking about it.
For the answer, I don't know if there are more questions or would you like to make any comment? Yes, I think that we have another one. Yes. Or if you want to express something about that you were quite surprised about, or if there is something that you thought, wow, I didn't know that or. Well, I will. I think that there are more questions. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for this interesting presentation. Well, my name is Albert. I'm one of the professors in the subject. And one of the things that I always, or we try to communicate in this subject, it's that no matter if you are just managing or planning for a tourism in a very small urban attraction, whether it's a larger natural area that you are dealing with tourism issues, be it an excess or whatever. It's always central, we tell them, to put in the center of the picture the community, the local community. Because in the end, the success, the failure, the satisfaction, insatisfaction, it all depends on how the communities accept or agree or like, push or oppose some of the management measures. So it's all about them in the end. And I think your presentation was an excellent example of this. I mean, it's very clear that most of the time that you devoted in explaining us the management model and everything, it was about the communities. And I was personally very surprised, and that's what I would like to ask you, about the title of the management plan, because, well, you talked about National Park Partnership Plan. I don't know if that's, I have never heard of something like this. I don't know if it's something singular from this national park, or whether it's a Scottish thing or a UK thing. Because I think it reflects, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it probably reflects this desire to put communities in the center, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. I think because we're a small country, and because we've brought national parks quite late to the table, we're having to find a way to integrate them with the way life works here, and. You could contrast that with what happened in, you know, the United States and Canada, where some of the first national parks were developed, you know, 100 years ago. But in those areas, any native people, any local people who were living in these areas, where they were cleared out. You had a big landscape and the local people were removed from the area so that the wilderness area could be looked after. Now, nowadays, that's not going to be a politically acceptable way to do things. And in our country, where things have to be a bit more integrated, we just don't have the space to draw big exclusive lines around things. So the whole exercise was very much an exercise in how do we involve people in caring for nature, caring for the environment. Also, because we are a government funded project, we need political support. And if there's not local people saying this is a good thing, then we don't have the political support. Inevitably, there are still some local people who are very opposed to what we're doing. I mean, what we're doing is still quite controversial. If you read the local papers, every week we are being criticized for something. But we have a governance model. I didn't really speak about it much, but we have 19 board members who oversee the preparation of this partnership plan, and 5 of them are directly elected every 5 years by the people who live within the national park. So you only get to vote if you live within the national park, and you get to vote for someone that you trust locally. Typically, that's a farmer or someone who knows a lot of people and is trusted. And then after those 5 people, there's another 7 people are local politicians. So quite a lot of, out of the 19 people, you know, 7 plus 5 is 12. 12 of the 19 are locally elected people, and the remainder are coming more from the national interest and usually are appointed because of their expertise in climate change or ecology or something. But that, again, that governance model is all trying to reinforce this sense of we're trying to do it with local people, but get the balance right between national and local interests. And the point about the partnership plan, yes, I think in most national parks in the world or nature parks would have something that they call a management plan, but we are trying to place the emphasis on, look, this is not about one organization having a plan. This is about the place and how can we manage it in a collaborative way. So yeah, hopefully it's innovative and interesting to people.
Well, Murray, again, thank you very much for your time and for the presentation. And we think that the students have appreciated this preparation in this case, and we are very grateful for that. And we will prepare some news for the webpage of the university and so on. So we will send the links after that, after all. And well, thank you again. Applause for him. Thank you.
Not at all. I hope you'll be able to come and visit sometime. We had a big conference here in 2018 when the annual conference of the Europark Federation was here. But Scotland's not so far away, so I hope some of you can come and visit at some time and see it for yourself. And there's lots of information on our website related to what I've been talking about. And if you need any more, please get in touch through Jordi.
Okay, perfect. So thank you very much. Have a nice day. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, thank you now. Goodbye.